there is a tension throughout the book of murkiness, right? And that underlying knowledge that, you know, people lie.
You know, it sounds cold to say everybody there lies, but I think everybody there's, or most of the folks that we talk to, actually believe a lot of their lies.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound, conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. Voter fraud and rigged elections have become such buzzwords in these conspiratorial times that you might not realize there are very few documented cases where election fraud actually happened. Maybe the biggest case in modern American history happened in 2018 in the race for the 9th Congressional District in North Carolina. The State Board of Elections threw out the original election after finding evidence of a scheme to illegally collect absentee ballots and tamper with some of those ballots to favor Republican candidates. The investigation centered on Bladen County, a small county at one end of the big congressional district, and McCrae Dowless, a longtime political operative from Bladen County. He and several others have been indicted on criminal charges related to the scheme. Today on Southbound, we talk to the co-authors of a new book on Dallas and the 9th District election. It's written by Michael Graff, editor of the news site Axios Charlotte, and Nick Oxner, chief investigative reporter for WBTV in Charlotte. The book is called The Vote Collectors, and it's out November 16th. I learned a ton of new details in the book and in our talk about McCrae Dowless and the election fraud case. But I also learned a lot about the history of Bladen County and Eastern North Carolina, and about how battles over race and power have been going on there long before the rest of the country started to pay attention. Here's our conversation. Let's just start simple. How did you guys end up coming together to write this book?
It started over a beer at Michael's brother's house, unfurnished, newly acquired house, one day in late February. Michael and I, of course, had both separately been reporting on the 9th Congressional District scandal and Bladen County. I'd already started thinking about writing a book about it all because I realized these people are just so crazy and there's a good story here. But I had had a run of bad press following some untrue allegations made under oath by a witness at the 9th Congressional District hearing held by the State Board of Elections that I couldn't really talk about and defend myself against at the time. And Mike knew I'd had a bad day or week on the internet and invited me over for a beer, and I needed a beer. And over a couple of beers, we decided that we should write a book together.
And Michael, what I'm trying to remember, you were coming at it, you had been writing stories about it, or were you in the midst of doing those stories?
At that time, I had already done the story that I was going to do for Politico by the time Nick and I had that beer. I ran into Nick when I was reporting in Bladen County for Politico. Nick and I have been friends for a couple of years, but, you know, we kind of laughed. We saw each other at the courthouse in Elizabethtown, thought maybe we should get together more, like things happen. And, but, you know, I came home from there, wrote a story, and I had written later that month in December of 2019, I wrote a story about the role race and plays in Eastern North Carolina politics going back to Reconstruction. And I'd sort of known that I wanted to write a book about Eastern North Carolina throughout my career. I just love it out there. I love the landscape. I love the water. I love the people. I just like a lot of things about it. It just feels natural to be there. But I always thought I would write a book called East of 95, and it would be about crabbers and fishermen and all these people who make up this wonderful part of the state. But then I wrote this essay for Charlotte Magazine on race and elections, and a friend of a friend said, you know, that's the book you should be writing. And 2 months later, I'm having a beer with Nick, and he says, I've got access to this great book about Eastern North Carolina and or this great story about Eastern North Carolina that could be a book. And I was like, let's do this together.
How do you feel like, what did each of you sort of bring to the table?
We really complement each other. I mean, it's uncanny. And I think that's why our partnership worked out so well. You know, there is, I don't know of a better writer than Michael Graff, right? He has a beautiful way with words that I don't have. He's got an astute eye. He knows how to just tell beautiful stories about important things. And I can't do any of that. So I'm very envious of his ability to do all of that and grateful that he lent that talent and skill to our book. And, you know, I brought access to people and documents and facts that kind of underpin that story. And so I like to say, you know, I kind of framed the house and Mike came along and did all the finish work and made it all beautiful.
I think some people who are listening to this are going to know a lot about this story, and maybe others are going to know a little less. So I want to try to serve both those audiences there. So at the center of the story is this guy named McCrae Dallas, somebody that I think has become pretty well known in nationally as well as in North Carolina. Could you all explain a little bit first about maybe who he is, and then maybe secondly, some things that are in this book about him that maybe even people who have followed this story won't know?
Well, I think it's interesting. We have two different perspectives on McCrae because Nick got to know him long before I did. Nick got to know him right after the scandal broke out. And I came along later as Nick's co-author. So we had different perspectives on who he was. But McCrae is a lifelong Bladen County resident, is as Bladen County as you can possibly get. You know, Nick has the great story of, you know, every reporter in the world for about a week was trying to get him on the phone. Somehow Nick, through a friend of a friend of a friend, got him on the phone, and McCrae Dallas out of nowhere tells Nick, "You're coming to the house, ain't you?" And it's just like, this is the type of person you're talking about, like very elusive, but once he likes somebody, he'll let you in. So when I came along to report, I decided that I was going to, I was not going to talk to McCrae at any point without a tape recorder. Like, I just thought it was very important, especially with Nick being sort of having this relationship where McCrae would call him about every time he spilled a glass of tea. Like, I wanted to be very professional, like never have our interviews questioned, I guess, for the book. So everything in the book is from interviews with him, you know, that were taped. So I wanted to be sure of that. But he was skittish. He called Nick one day and said, he said, I just don't get comfortable with Mike. He's always got that recorder around or something like that, you know. And it's just like McCrae, like, and I think Nick said, McCrae, this book's not going to get written without Mike. So he was a fascinating guy. I mean, Nick has a very close relationship with him. And I had a relationship where he was simply a source for a story. And, you know, it was wild that way.
Nick, how did you feel about that relationship? And what did you discover along the way about McCrae that maybe stuff you didn't know at the beginning?
Yeah, well, let's start with when I first called McCrae. He was expecting my call, and he says, "You come to the house?" And I said, "Of course, yes." And I go to the house. At that point, McCrae was this political mastermind at the center of an alleged voting fraud that may have included throwing ballots away, altering ballots, right, in this widespread criminal enterprise. What I found was, you know, a country boy living in a brick ranch in Bladenboro, off Bladenboro Airport Road. He liked me because I'm from Hope Mills, 30 minutes down the road. As I like to say, the closest point of civilization you can get to Bladen County. And I'd come recommended from this guy who recommended me because he knew some people that I knew, and that's how we'd gotten in touch. And so he trusted me because I wasn't, you know, another Charlotte reporter. I wasn't from New York or DC or, you know, anywhere else. And I was, you know, down east, so to speak, even though technically I live just west of 95. And so we really, when you start to unpack McRae. And I think the first time I realized that there was more depth to him, we were talking about how he got into politics. And I realized he got into politics to avenge his felony prosecution. Basically, McRae Dallas's journey into politics involves committing check cashing fraud, or insurance fraud, really, involving a forged check. And he was prosecuted, but he felt like he was prosecuted unfairly. And when he got out of his relatively short prison sentence, he decided he wanted to try to oust the district attorney who had prosecuted him. And the rest, as you could say, is history.
As you go through this book and you find out more about McRae, and then you find out more about many of the other people involved in the story, Mark Harris, the congressional candidate, Dan McCready, the congressional candidate, a lot of the McRae's sort of helpers in this story, all those things. You make pretty clear in the story that just about everybody lies at one point or another in this story. Like, somebody tells somebody one thing and then tells somebody else something the exact opposite. I guess I wonder how you two navigated doing a kind of story where there was a decent chance that anybody you talk to, up to and including a Baptist preacher, might be lying to you.
I just assumed at every point, certainly on Bladen County soil, that everyone was lying to me. And it was really tough, especially in the early days, right? Where you're trying to, as a TV reporter, I'm trying to report very quickly, right? I'm putting something new on TV every day, sometimes multiple times a day. But I couldn't do that without documented proof, right? I will also say this about Mark Harris. The first time I interviewed him, which was the first time he'd spoken publicly since his election had not been certified, I was prepared for him to lie about how McRae came to work for him. I knew at that point that he'd hired McRae, but he hadn't said that publicly. And so I sat down with Mark Harris to do the interview, and the first questions I had was, how did McRae come to work for you? And he told me the truth. He said, I hired him. And when you're an investigative reporter like me, you sit, you know, you got like the thing that you really think you're going to, you know, chase someone down on. And he just admitted, you know, he just said it right there. But no, I mean, McRae told me one time, well, hell, you can't trust anyone down here. Everybody lies in Bladen County. And that's absolutely true. And I think we do a good job. I hope we do a good job in the book of trying to paint for the reader. This is the best version of the truth as we were able to ascertain, and we think it's right, which is why we published it. And here are the bases for why we think that. But, you know, I think there is a tension throughout the book of murkiness, right? And that underlying knowledge that, you know, people lie.
You know, it sounds cold to say everybody there lies, but I think everybody there's, and or most of the folks that we talk to, actually believe a lot of their lies. Like, I think that there's a lot of folks actually talk themselves into believing that, you know, everybody's the hero in their own story, right? Like, so they don't believe that they've done anything wrong. And that was the really interesting part to me. I mean, when we got to the end with Mark Harris, the preacher, or the politician and preacher, after sitting with him, I got the sense that Mark absolutely believes he did nothing wrong. Absolutely. I mean, it is, and he may not have, like, let's just also say that, but he may have done a lot wrong too. Like, but I get the sense that he has, over the past 2 years, talked himself into believing that nothing he did was wrong, and he was wronged. He's still very hurt by the fact that he's not in Congress. Like, and so that was true from him to the folks we talked to in Bladen County. There was one moment where we were interviewing a woman named Lisa Britt, and she had called McRae out on a lie that he had said, like, I can't remember exactly what it was, but he had said he wasn't going somewhere, and he told us he wasn't going somewhere. And Lisa was like, actually, no, he was there, or something like that. We went back and Nick confronted him, and like, I'm watching this happen. Like, we're standing outside this little store in Bladenboro, and Nick said, "You lied to me." And then McRae like would called him back later that night and apologized for lying to him. Like, this happened all the time throughout the story. It was just it was just wild to sort of be navigating folks' versions of their own stories and knowing that other people had different versions of the story that they were telling us. And it was, and in some ways it's just, it just made it that much more interesting.
I think we have two more last addendums to add about truthfulness or lack thereof in Bladen County. One, best I can tell, I haven't found it yet, and I've looked. I can't find anywhere where McRae has said a large, meaningful lie, right? Like a verifiably, demonstrably untruth. We found like two white lies, I think, and we point them out in the book. But McRae largely has said to me that he's never lied to me, and which is why when we caught him in that little lie about Lisa Britt, why it was such a big deal, I think. But secondly, everyone that we just talked about and the names that we just threw out were all on one side of this issue. Literally everyone in Bladen County lies, Republicans, Democrats, independents, people involved in this and not involved in this. And so let's not think that this is limited to one party or the other, because it's everybody.
I want to ask Nick about one particular piece of reporting. Michael brought up Lisa Britt, and who I think was the source of the bad day you were having when all this started. And you sort of detail in the book how Lisa basically told investigators one thing about her involvement in all this. She is, by the way, McRae Dallas's stepdaughter, right? And she told investigators, yes, they did illegal things. Then she sat down for an interview with you and basically said the opposite. And that was a big story at the time because she had not been out there before and all that sort of thing. As you detail in the book, that interview happened at McRae Dallas's house, and he was present. And I think as a viewer, that would have been context that would have helped me evaluate whether she was telling the truth or not. And I know at the time he probably had not talked to anybody on the record yet, and I know you were kind of working him as a source and everything, but do you feel like any of that one little piece of what y'all did may have been kind of misleading in any way to people who are watching?
Absolutely
it?
Not.
Okay, well,
no,
explain.
Absolutely not. Yeah, and I'm happy to now. And I should say, I couldn't talk about it at the time because McRae Dallas at the time was a confidential source and we'd made a confidential agreement. So I couldn't discuss it because it would have revealed him as a source. Obviously, he cooperated for the book. He's revealed himself to be a source and we don't have that confidential relationship anymore, just to clear that up. And so, one, I couldn't reveal that he was in the kitchen because he was a confidential source and I didn't have authorization to do that. Reporters work with sources all the time, and the confidential nature of having a source and a source-reporter relationship is not unique to this story or to me. Two, Lisa Britt, as we detail in the book, you know, showed up like 2 hours past the – she called me one day. I'm having lunch at the Italian place in Elizabethtown. There's an Italian place, two Mexican places, and maybe one other place. And so I'm having lunch at the Italian place. Great salad. Good food. And she calls me and says, I'm ready to talk to you. And I had something else planned that day, but obviously I'm going to stop what I'm doing to go interview Lisa Britt. She was the first of anyone related to McRae Dallas who was going to talk on the record. And I'd been trying to get her, and I'd been trying to get McRae and a lot of other people to talk, but she was the first one. So she said, meet me here at this time. It was like 4 or 4:30, which as a news guy is not conducive to a 6 o'clock deadline, right? We have other shows, but, you know, so it was a little late, but we could make that work. And she ends up being like 2 hours late for the interview. So she gets there. She asks if she has time to do some makeup and do her hair a little bit more. Fine with me. And so we're sitting her down. We are at McRae's house. That's where she told me to meet her. I didn't dictate the terms of this. We're sitting in McRae's kitchen and I think he was actually out of the room. And she says to me, can McRae be in the room for this? And I said, it's up to you. Just like it's up to anyone else. If a PR person sits off camera when I interview, you know, the dog catcher or whatever, right? That's not unusual. I don't think there was anything misleading there. I don't think there was anything unethical there. And the importance to me of that interview was, because here is someone connected to this side of the story that no one has heard from before, putting on the record claims of how they say this happened. It's not my job to judge whether they're true or not. right? I didn't say this is exactly what happened because Lisa Britt told me. I said, here's what Lisa Britt is saying. And ultimately, look what happened as a result of that. Immediately, the State Board of Elections had a court reporter transcribe her interview with me, and they used that at the hearing. It is vitally important to record someone's version of events, whether it's true or not. In some ways, we are stenographers, right, as reporters. And so that is what I did that day. I didn't shill for one side or the other. There's no way to instantaneously fact check, but someone that we haven't heard from before making claims about a newsworthy event is news. And I don't think her claims would have been couched in any different context if you knew she'd asked for McRae Dallas to sit 6 feet away or not.
I want to ask a bigger question about that kind of stuff in general. This is not a flattering portrait of McRae Dallas that comes out in the book. I think you describe him in various ways as a flim-flam man, a con artist, and a master manipulator. And he was trying to manipulate everybody involved in this thing, including the two of you. And I'm wondering if, as you were doing the reporting or the writing or whatever, that you came across places where maybe he at least temporarily had succeeded.
I think that's why we have two of us, and I'll let Mike answer really, but I'll just say this. That's why we had two of us. And that's why it was helpful to have both of us write this book.
There was a lot of little white lies. Did he fool us in any way? I think that there were times that I went home and thought, I really like this guy. And like, that was a really strange feeling to know what I knew about him and to know that he was lying to me and to know he has, here's a guy with a criminal background and has done things in his past that were really just slimy and, was continuing to try to manipulate us in some ways. But still, I went home and I was like, man, it's kind of funny. Like, and he's like, he's entertaining and he got me. And then I wake up in the middle of the night and be like, he got me there. I think, he got me to like him, which is what a manipulator does, I feel like. And, he got us. There were times when I was like, he's an interesting guy, and I want to go back and hear more. Of course, I couldn't go back and sometimes Nick and I would go to his house and we had to set time limits before we walked in because I was like, he's going to smoke like 12 cigarettes and I am allergic to this. And like my throat would close up and like, I was like, we just got to get out of here. And, I don't know that he ever completely fooled us, but we did, I watched him lie to other people too. And you just kind of know at that point that at some point he's probably lied to us, but we were in the room once. The line in the book that's probably the quote in the book that's probably my favorite quote is we're interviewing him in his office. And as most of the podcast listeners will know, Zoe Chase from This American Life had been working on the same story and she was, or a similar story, and she was going to do a serial podcast series about it. And McRae, for whatever reason, had told Nick that Nick was the only person he was going to do interviews with, and by extension, me. But Nick always told McRae, you can interview anybody with anybody you want. And we have this on tape and transcribed by a third party and everything, just to like be safe with all of our facts here. Zoe called while we were interviewing him, and he answered and he talked to her and he was polite to her. And he said, I'm not doing interviews right now, or something like that. And while he was in an interview, by the way, like with us, so there's a lie there. But he got off the phone and he said, there's only one man I'm talking to. And he pointed at Nick and he said something like, and the quote was, the only thing I have left is my integrity. And I was just like, holy cow, I cannot believe you just said that in my presence, like after lying to a reporter on the other line, like the only thing I have. And I just think that our book, I hope for everybody, I hope we sit in that sentence for a long time. I hope everybody sits in that sentence for a long time, because it's like, the only thing I have left is my integrity. But like, in some ways, what is integrity? And it, like, the McRae challenges the notion of integrity, I think, all the time.
When we come back, Nick Oxner and Michael Graff talk about how McRae Dallas was an expert at combining high-level politics with a low-tech style.
is actually pretty sophisticated stuff, right? Voter targeting, you know, getting voter rolls, picking which voters you should target to register and turn out to the polls. I mean, people in DC and in Raleigh make a lot of money doing that exact thing. And here's a dude doing it in a smoky wood paneled kitchen with a pencil and reams of paper.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to today's episode, I want to take just a second to let you know about the treasures we've got in the Southbound archives. We've done more than 100 episodes now. By my rough calculations, you could drive all the way from Charlotte to San Francisco, existing on nothing but Southbound episodes, plus the occasional snack. So there's bound to be something you love. Interested in music? I've done episodes with Ben Folds, Rhiannon Giddens, Anthony Hamilton, Patterson Hood, and many, many others. Comedy? How about Roy Wood Jr., Fortune Feimster, and Nate Bargatze? Sports? Dale Earnhardt Jr. and Paul Feinbaum. Fashion? Andre Leon Talley and Billy Reid. Plus so many others, from Chef Vivian Howard, to writer Rick Bragg, to actress Brooklyn Decker. I also talked to many Southerners who might not be as famous, but are doing important work, from whale watcher Clay George to hip-hop scholar Regina Bradley. You can dive into the archives by following Southbound on any of your favorite podcast providers or by going to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. Enjoy the journey. And now, back to my conversation with Michael Graff and Nick Oxner. I want to kind of pull back like you guys pulled back in this book. The middle third of this book kind of steps away from the present day, so to speak. And it's a deep dive into the history of Bladen County and that whole part of eastern North Carolina. Could you all talk a little bit about why you felt that that was important and how it tied in to those present day things y'all are writing about?
I thought it was the, it was the part I wouldn't say most interested in, but it was, you know, I had written that essay about that. I had had all these notes through reporting through the years, and I just knew a lot of the stuff about Eastern North Carolina and the history of race and politics there. But I actually, when we sat down to write the book, I thought this is the part that could separate it and make it a lot different from just a run-of-the-mill political book that details everything that happened in a current or present-day scam or controversy or something like that. I thought this is where we can really ground the book and connect it to the soil and show that these things have roots that go back to Reconstruction. And, you know, within the first few weeks of doing research and newspapers and things like that, I found this just unbelievable connection, which is that George Henry White, the last Black congressman before Jim Crow laws effectively removed all Black men from Congress, was born in Bladen County and raised in Bladen County and had a very, very strained relationship, let's say, with Eastern North Carolina after all of the grandfather clauses and things like that left him without a job in Congress. And so I contacted, you know, I started to dig back deeper into his history, and I found that he was connected to one of the most prominent Black families in Eastern North Carolina, and just thought, and they had a historian who was willing to work on the book with me. And I was like, holy cow, this is going to be so great. And to me, it was important because it connects straight from George Henry White and to his uncle, to be honest, who was the first Black elected official in Bladen County. It draws the line from George Henry White, and you can see the two or three steps that happened from there, and the reasons he was pushed out of office, and the reasons that organizations like the Bladen County Improvement Association had to be formed to begin with. Like, there's only one or two steps between there and the Bladen County Improvement Association becoming a powerful political organization in Bladen County that white people could not stand and cannot stand, and to this day. And that was just fascinating to me to think that, I mean, I can just run through the steps really quickly. George Henry White gets out of Congress. He's pushed out of Congress. Black political organizations have to be formed in North Carolina to get people elected and to get representation. 50 years later, the Bladen County Improvement Association is very, very successful. They get a majority Black County Commissioner Board, and they get a sheriff elected. And look what happens. There's a backlash to it. And this was part of the backlash. The 2018 scandal was part of the backlash.
Could you tell our listeners why Bladen County doesn't have a county fair anymore?
This might be the craziest story of all that we unearthed in the book, actually.
Is it? Gosh, this was a strange story of sad. A white woman was murdered at her house, and a Black traveling carnival worker was charged with the crime. The wild part of that story was that after he was charged, he was picked up in a sheriff's car, and the people, the white folks in Bladen County, surrounded the sheriff's car in a field, waiting for this man, waiting to get a shot at this man. And the white sheriff at the time basically said, no, he's going to have his day in court, and took him out. Like, and so in this county where racism really runs deep, you know, they did have a white sheriff at some point take this man away safely. And the craziest part is I have tried and tried. We tried so hard to find that man, because I have no obituary. I couldn't find an obituary. We talked to the state prison system. They said he was discharged in the 80s. And it's just like, we tried so hard to find this man. I could never find him.
And so since then, because of that thing that happened in the 50s, they haven't had a county fair since, right?
Never. No county fair.
They didn't want traveling people coming through.
But they do have this thing called the Beast Fest, which I think is its own, it tells its own sort of metaphorical story about what Bladen County is like, right?
Wow. We're really getting into it. Yeah. So the Beast Fest is also in the, I guess, the 50s. Yes. It was a crazy time to be in Bladen County in the 50s. People's animals, people's dogs, people's cats were showing up dead. Folks invented this theory that a big, large Black cat was roaming around Bladen County, killing all these animals, and it became like a vampire cat in the local newspapers. And then I look back and you find that these sorts of stories actually happened all over North Carolina and probably all throughout the South. Like every time an unexplained animal or an animal turns up unexplained dead. I mean, it happened in Charlotte here around Briar Creek. There was like a Beast of Briar Creek, I think, at some point. But the only place to turn it into a festival that I know of was Bladen County. So yes, they have the Beast Fest every year. It's a place where politicians gather, and it's a place where the Lumbees bring over their collard sandwiches every year.
It struck me that both those stories talk about, you know, the three of us live in Charlotte, and Charlotte is always remaking itself, and so much of the South is always remaking itself over and over and over, and, you know, digging up the old and starting the new. Bladen County, and correct me if I'm wrong, but maybe this feels like why this place was ripe for this kind of thing to happen, is a place, it's like that Faulkner cliche, you know, the past ain't even past. Like all these things that happened decades ago are still reflected in how people act and behave today, and everybody there remembers.
Oh, it was really important to me, and I think to Michael, but definitely to me, that we transport the reader to the extent that we can to Bladen County. It very much feels still like in an older era, right? I mean, if you drive, it's a 2.5 hour drive from Charlotte to Bladen County, but it feels like, you know, you go back decades in time. And that's both in the physical setting, right, in place. Are people still smoking? There's wood paneling on most walls. You know, you can still go down to the corner store and get a lunch for, you know, $3. And in the way they think, and because everyone is still from around there and most people are kin, you know, I owed McCray a phone call over this past weekend, and I called him back on Sunday, and he answered and said, "Hey, I'm having a family reunion. We got 250 of us, all first cousins and second cousins." And so Bladen County is very much a place where everyone knows each other or is related, and they've known each other. We would sit, Michael and I would sit with McCray in front of Dove's Barbecue in Bladenboro. You know, everyone that walked by, McCray would know, and they'd share a story, you know, from the, you know, which you could tell were their glory days, which all had happened 20 or 30 years ago. Yeah, that stuff still matters. Everyone is still remembering that. And in a lot of ways, the 9th Congressional District scandal was all predicated on things that had happened almost a decade earlier. And when you start to understand that, I think you start to understand the story of how this could happen a little bit better.
It also struck me that in a time when we think about voter manipulation as being like computer hackers trying to get into machines, or the Russians or whatever trying to do this, this is like the most analog crime, you know, just collecting ballots that they weren't supposed to collect, and or potentially, as some people allege, throwing away ballots they didn't want to be voted.
The director of the State Board of, or the former director of the State Board of Elections, Kim Strack, has said, she said actually at a forum at Davidson, that there's no evidence that the board found that any ballots were thrown away. But if you get down to what McCray was doing, up till if he was collecting those ballots, and that's not been adjudicated, he actually is due in court one day before a book comes out, but is actually pretty sophisticated stuff, right? Voter targeting, you know, getting voter rolls, picking which voters you should target to register and turn out to the polls. I mean, people in DC and in Raleigh make a lot of money doing that exact thing. And here's a dude doing it in a smoky wood paneled kitchen with a pencil and reams of paper.
One of the things I was thinking about after I finished all the book is that, you know, in one sense, what you've documented, Menon, is basically the only major case of voter fraud in modern U.S. history, at least in the way we define voter fraud. But you also, especially in this more historical part of the book, document so many instances throughout our history, not just in North Carolina, but obviously in other places, where elections have been rigged through changing of laws or even intimidation, you know, the Wilmington riots, which basically was a coup, you know, all those sorts of things. And I guess what I'm trying to figure out is there anything that y'all came across that gave you faith in our system?
No. And I mean, that's a big answer, right? But I'll say this, my big takeaway from this is nothing has been done to address the root cause of the 2018 scandal, right? Nothing has been done to fix the system, because the system wasn't just McCray Dallas or wasn't just Mark Harris. Fundamentally, democracy works and is stable. So this isn't just me questioning democracy, but it is me saying democracy relies on rules and laws and people taking steps to enforce those rules and laws. And a big part of what we spend in the book is laying out all of the warning signs years ahead of the 2018 election and no one doing anything about it. And here we have, you know, McCray and a couple other folks that have been charged with crimes that they haven't been in court yet for 2 years later. You know, it's business as usual writ large in Bladen County. McCray's been sidelined from the political landscape, but you know, this was a problem that was bigger than just McCray Dallas, and we pretended like we solved it by focusing on McCray Dallas. And that should be alarming to anyone who cares about clean elections and democracy in Bladen County and elsewhere.
Yeah, I think there were people we encountered that gave me a lot of faith. There's a guy in the book named Josh Lawson who worked at the State Board of Elections. He gives me faith. Like, people like him, where he tried so hard to get people to recognize what was going on there. I mean, he begged and pleaded with attorneys and and begging people to like pay attention. So we have people like that that give me faith, but you know, I do have fear that an overall system where millions upon millions and billions of dollars are poured into politics now, and it's become one of the biggest economies in our like industries in our country, and folks are going to these poor and rural areas where there's not a lot of money, where these massive campaigns with, you know, Dan McCready and Mark Harris were coming in with almost $10 million between them. How many jobs could that have funded in that area? So I do think that as the money goes into politics more, the chances of people being taken advantage of for their votes in places like this just increases. And that's the scary part to me.
And one last thing, I want to kind of tie this into, as you guys tie into and sort of the epilogue of the book, talking about kind of tying up some loose ends, and one of those being that as y'all were finishing this book, the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol happened. You know, you guys mentioned earlier about how you can sort of talk yourself into believing something. And I felt like that's what so many people who went to Washington on January 6th felt like. And I guess I just wanted to ask y'all how you see these things kind of tied together, if at all.
Well, there was the very clear link that a lot of some of the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys were meeting in the woods of Columbus County, which is, you know, the county that borders Bladen, to sort of shoot guns in the woods and things like that in the swamp. So that was a pretty clear connection to us to know that Eastern North Carolina had a tie to it. But other connections are simply, you know, and that's the fear is not knowing what to believe or believing your own story against all the facts that mount up against your own story. And I think obviously that's what we saw on January 6th was there was a series of facts that thousands of people have chosen not to believe, millions of people have chosen not to believe. And we kind of live at a time where you can find your own facts. You can look on the internet long enough and find your own facts about things and convince yourself that you're right. And so I think those the larger theme of the book, integrity and trust and dishonesty and things like that, definitely played into obviously what happened on January 6th. But there, as we turn in the book on September, the first draft of the book in September of 2020, and I can't tell you the number of times we wanted to change, like go in and add stuff to this epilogue, because Donald Trump would say something about voter fraud or election fraud, and I'd be like, God, we know more about it than he does. Like, we know more about this thing than he does. And yeah, it was a wild stretch.
The thing that stuck with me most after reading The Vote Collectors and after talking to Michael Graff and Nick Oxner is just how much it feels like the preview to a bigger movie. An election doesn't have to be rigged with Chinese space lasers or whatever craziness bubbles up from some Facebook thread. An election can swing on a few people who are willing to do simple, illegal things. And they might do those simple, illegal things not necessarily because they love one candidate or hate another, but because of grievances that go back to damn near the founding of this country. The fuse for what happened in Bladen County in 2018 was lit long, long ago, and it never seems to go out. The fake election fraud so many people are still clinging to with Donald Trump's loss last year comes from the same place as the real election fraud that happened in Bladen County. If your identity gets tied up in a candidate, then you can't allow that candidate to lose, or else you lose a piece of yourself. That thinking leaves an empty space where your conscience should be. And people like McCrae Dallas step right into the void. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.